and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the release of the much-awaited and anticipated Chilcot report, whose Iraq inquiry investigated the UK decision to join the Bush administration's determination to go to war in Iraq, an intervention that the report states went badly wrong, leading to the Iraqi people suffering greatly, with consequences still being felt to this day. Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan, joins us to discuss the glaring fact that no such inquiry has been conducted in the United States, and while the former UK Prime Minister is blasted for overstating the threat from Saddam Hussein, sending ill-prepared troops into battle with wholly inadequate plans for the aftermath, Tony Blair did not go to jail as a war criminal, which under the UN Charter is the fate that he, Bush and Cheney should have faced. Then, following the FBI's rebuke of Hillary Clinton, we will examine the role of Russian intelligence and its propaganda arm, the English-language TV network Russia Today, as the source of much of what has come to light from digging up dirt on Hillary Clinton by hacking her emails and into the Clinton Foundation's servers as well as the DNC's servers. Franklin Foyer, a New America Fellow and a contributing editor at Slate magazine, joins us to discuss how and why Putin is supporting Donald Trump and his latest article at Slate, Putin's Puppet, If the Russian President Could Design a Candidate to Undermine American Interests and Advance His Own, He'd Look a Lot Like Donald Trump. Then finally, we'll speak to John Dunbar, the deputy executive editor at the Center for Public Integrity and creator of Consider the Source, the center's ongoing investigation into the impact of money on state and federal politics. He joins us to discuss his latest article, Koch Brothers' Plight is Likened to That of Civil Rights Workers in the 1950s, which reveals how America's billionaire plutocrats have got a federal judge to rule that their rights to spend unlimited amounts of dark money to shape elections is comparable to the rights of the NAACP to keep its membership lists secret from the KKK, who were out to kill civil rights workers in the 1950s. And joining us now is Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com and the author of a number of books, the latest of which is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Thank you, Ian.
And the much-anticipated Chilcot report about the Iraq war conducted by the British Parliament, by an independent commission sanctioned or founded by the British Parliament, have finally come out with their devastating critique of the build-up to the Iraq war, and in particular of Prime Minister Tony Blair. No such report is in the works in this country. No such report is even being proffered in this country by any political authority that I know of. So let's begin with that premise. What is wrong with this country if they can't look into the biggest foreign policy disaster perhaps in the history of the United States and assess its origins in order not to repeat the mistakes? I mean, after all, the Brexit vote that just took place in the UK that's got everybody shaking at the insanity of it all, you can trace its genesis all the way back to the invasion of Iraq by Bush, Cheney, and Blair et al., because they unraveled this situation in the Middle East, and the ongoing collateral damage continues to this day.
Yes, the Democratic Party leadership under Nancy Pelosi made a pledge even before the 2008 presidential election that there would be no prosecution for the Iraq War. And to some extent, this may be, the long history and experience of the Democratic Party, because they felt that they had succeeded in unseating Dick Nixon with Watergate, but after a brief presidency of Jimmy Carter, the Republicans grabbed the White House for a long time, and the Democrats felt that when you undermine the public's faith in government, you're giving away the show to the Republicans, whose message is that you can't trust government, that it's no good, that it never does anything well, and that the private sector is all. So I think that the Democrats didn't make an inquiry into Bush or have a special prosecutor because they didn't want to undermine faith in government.
Well, and also, of course, a lot of prominent Democrats voted for the war, including Hillary Clinton and John Kerry. So to that extent, the loyal opposition certainly failed us at the time of the authorization vote based upon bogus intelligence, even though there were people like Senator Bob Graham, the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, telling his colleagues that the NIO that was being put forth by the Bush administration to justify the invasion of Iraq was completely bogus. So there's a lot of shame to go around, I assume. Well, I find it extraordinarily ironic, Juan Cole, that the only person in American politics who's pointing out the folly of the Iraq war and the devastating consequences is, of all people, Donald Trump.
Yes, although, to be fair, Mr. Trump appears to have had no problem with the war at the time. He was asked on the radio if he supported it, and he said, I guess so. He wasn't maybe enthusiastic about it, but his later portrayal of himself as a war opponent is, tinkering with history. And then he's taken altogether the wrong message away, which is that the United States should support brutal dictators like Saddam Hussein, and that if only the dictators remained in office, then everything would be fine, which doesn't reckon with the very extensive loss of life to Iraqis under the Saddam regime, which invaded two neighbors and persecuted its own Shiites and Kurds.
Well, we certainly, I certainly don't turn to Donald Trump for a political and a geopolitical role model, and one hopes that the American people don't. And again, I'm speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com. And his latest book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. So let's turn to the substance of the Chilcot Report, which really does hold Tony Blair responsible. And they say the war was based on flawed intelligence that went unchallenged, on shaky legal rationales, inadequate preparation, and exaggerated public statements. And there, of course, was no follow-on or no day-after plans. what more could you say?
Well, unfortunately, however, the likelihood is that nothing bad will happen to Tony Blair. He did commit a war crime. I mean, it is illegal under the United Nations Charter to launch an aggressive war on a country which has not attacked you and without any United Nations Security Council authorization. And he was warned by his then Attorney General that he could well be prosecuted, and the whole cabinet could have been prosecuted for the crime of an aggressive war. And I think it's very unfortunate that they've gotten away with it.
Well, has he gotten away with it, though, in the end of the day? I don't know whether the judgment of history is the same as going to jail for war crimes, but it's pretty extraordinary when you look at the report. The sort of, they used to refer to Blair as America's poodle or Bush's poodle, but he certainly comes across that way. He's basically appealing to Bush's religiosity, using the word evil in this Manichaean kind of fundamentalist Christian way that informed George W. Bush's thinking. I find the whole thing disgusting and craven, frankly, because he didn't get anything out of it, did he?
No, I think at the time, Blair's impression of Washington under Bush was that it was full of wild men. And so we have from the former UK ambassador to Washington some memoirs of the aftermath of the September 11th attacks, when the Bush administration wanted to attack Iraq at that time. And Blair and others tried to convince them that it would be a huge disaster to run off to Iraq and start a war. and leave bin Laden and al-Qaeda and their training camps alone in Afghanistan, which was the first instinct of the Bush administration. They were looking for any pretext to invade Iraq. And the former UK ambassador at the time has written that it is his belief that Blair promised Bush support on Iraq at a later time, if only he would take care of al-Qaeda first. Bush kind of had to be bribed to do what any rational person would do.
Well, did, at the end of the day, though, do you think Tony Blair had any inkling the extent of how much he should have been dealing with Dick Cheney, how much he was pushing things and, in effect, manipulating the kid?
Well, I think, yes, I think that Blair and Colin Powell were both aware of Cheney's influence, and that they, the evidence is that the two of them did what they could to offset it, and that was how Blair justified his role to himself, was that he and Powell, you know, played good cop, bad cop. They got Bush to go to the United Nations for an authorization that failed, but they felt that it would be deadly to the whole international order of the post-World War period to have the sole superpower just run off and go to war without even having approached the UN. So at various points, I think Blair saw himself as being able to intervene at the margins against Cheney. But Blair himself was being driven by, you know, regional and local concerns. There's some evidence that BP was afraid that they would be left out of the new oil deals that were coming once Saddam was overthrown. And so they contacted Blair to ask him to put down a marker for British oil interests. Blair wasn't, you know, the noble suffering hero in that regard either.
Well, you know, the greatest indictment, at least in sort of in practical terms as opposed to moral terms, the greatest indictment of Bush, Cheney, Rice and Rumsfeld and Blair is the geopolitical stupidity of what they did, which was they essentially, the only winner of the Iraq war has been Iran, and the losers have been the Iraqi people and, by extension, the Syrian people. And you've got this contagion. They didn't even want to go after al-Qaeda in the first place. But now you've got al-Qaeda and a new and virulent form of takfir, which is the self-declared Islamic State. So the evidence is just overwhelming of what they've wrought. But is there any evidence in any of this that anybody told these guys how stupid it was to invade Iraq, that the only winner would be Iran?
Well, I don't know if they were alerted to the issue of Iran, but they certainly, the British intelligence, tried to warn Blair that this is a very bad idea and that it would strengthen al-Qaeda. That came out in the Chilcot report. And so Blair knew, he was told by his intelligence officials, that he risked strengthening al-Qaeda by doing this. So he did it with his eyes open and decided that the risk was worth taking.
And what about the idea of changing the balance in the Middle East and strengthening Iran, which even though at the end of the day it may end up being a better bet that the Shia regimes may be more amenable to modus vivendi than the extreme Sunni regimes, particularly with the Wahhabism coming out of Saudi Arabia. But just in closing, was that ever the whole idea of the geopolitical chips falling? Not just if you break it, you own it. That hardly tells the whole picture. The real picture is you're going to upset the entire balance of power in the Middle East.
Well, I think there's some evidence that the Saudis were concerned about the overthrow of Saddam as a potential opening for Iran in the region. But they were disregarded, and the line of the neoconservatives around Bush in 2002 and early 2003 was that overthrowing Saddam was a first step towards overthrowing the regime in Iran. So they weren't afraid of Iran being able to benefit from what they were doing because they intended to go after it as well. And if the Iraq war had gone better, the saying in Washington at the time was that everyone wants to go to Baghdad, real men want to go to Tehran.
Well, these real men ended up being the biggest buffoons and idiots in history. And again, I'm referring to the practical as opposed to the moral. I mean, you know, if you think that Tony Blair should go to jail for war crimes, these guys should do a lot more time.
Yes, it's almost Shakespearean. It's sort of like Mark Antony. He didn't end up with Egypt after all, and Cleopatra ended up committing suicide.
Well, with that long view, I thank you, Juan. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
And I'm likewise, thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Inform Comment at juancole.com. And his latest book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Putin's puppet, Donald Trump. Such a creep. The lights went out, the orange dry. We blamed it on the other guy. Shit so thick you can stir with a stick. Free Teflon, whitewashed presidency. We're sick of being jerked around. Wear that on your sleeve. Broadcast me a joyful noise into the times. Lord, count your blessings. We're sick of being jerked around. We all fall down. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Franklin Foyer, who's a New America Fellow and a contributing editor at Slate Magazine. He's currently writing a book about the dark side of Silicon Valley, and his latest article at Slate is Putin's Puppet: If the Russian President Could Design a Candidate to Undermine American Interests and Advance His Own, He'd Look a Lot Like Donald Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Franklin Foyer.
Thank you for having me.
And much of what has transpired over the last day or so with the FBI director's announcement, basically letting Hillary off the hook legally, but slamming her for her extreme carelessness with handling classified data. And obviously this is something the Republicans have been pumping for a long time, and Donald Trump has called her Crooked Hillary as a result of this, and seems to have a massive investment in the idea that she should be disqualified because of this use of private email servers. But isn't the genesis of our knowledge about the servers themselves, don't they come from the Romanian hacker who hacked into Sid Blumenthal's personal account and thus led to the Benghazi committee finding out about it and then, by extension, the rest of the country? So let's start with that premise, that we only know about this because
there's an irony. Which is that Hillary Clinton's email servers are indeed vulnerable, and they have been hacked by foreign intelligence services, and not her State Department, the ones she was using necessarily at the State Department, but we know that the Democratic National Committee's servers have been hacked, and we know that the Clinton Foundation's servers have been hacked. And according to cybersecurity experts and the people who did the forensic investigations of those hacks, the hacks trace back to various Russian intelligence services. So I said that it's ironic. And the irony is that it seems like one of the core reasons that those servers were hacked was that the Russians, Russian intelligence, seems to have a rooting interest in this campaign, and their interest is against Hillary Clinton, and that they seem to have quite a bit of affection for Donald Trump. And it takes a little bit of effort to make the connections, and it's a bit of a circumstantial case, that one has to make, but I think that there's enough evidence that you can make a pretty compelling circumstantial case that that is so.
Well, we certainly know that the Russian FSB SVR hack of the DNC, what they took was the opposition research that the DNC had on Donald Trump. But Guccifer, this Romanian character who initially broke into Sid Blumenthal's private accounts and was able to therefore, by extension, get information or share emails or expose emails between Sid Blumenthal and Hillary Clinton. Was that the beginning? I mean, in other words, do we know whether Guccifer was working for the FSB or SVR, or was he just to...
I don't know that.
Right. He just could have been a false flag, which many of these people are. So what's your...
It's such a murky world.
Exactly. So what then is the... What do you think is Putin's motive here? Is he just observing, getting intel on the American election? He obviously needs to know who the next head of state's going to be. Or is he trying to shape the election?
That would be the most innocuous explanation, and he would hardly be alone in doing that. I mean, there's ample evidence that lots of intelligence services go poking around the servers of political campaigns because they want to know who's running and whether the presidential candidate will be somebody who they can do business with or will pose some sort of threat. But if we step back and we look at the broader Russian political strategy in Europe, what we see is that, especially in Eastern Europe, but also in Western Europe, there's Putin has provided patronage to various political parties, and these political parties tend to be right-wing, ethno-nationalist, opposed to the European Union, sympathetic to Russia, hostile to NATO. And in some instances, we have clear evidence linking them to the Kremlin, where they've been invited to... Their parties have spent lots of time in Moscow. And in some instances, we can see money flowing from Russia to various campaigns. We know that Russian propaganda has been active on behalf of a lot of these parties, and that Putin has a broader strategy, which is that he wants to sow dissension in Europe and to undermine the idea of a cohesive European foreign policy, because he views a cohesive foreign policy generally as a sanctions-imposing nuisance that prevents him from managing his own backyard.
And again, I'm speaking with Franklin Foyer, who's a New America Fellow and the contributing editor at Slate Magazine. He's currently writing a book about the dark side of Silicon Valley, and his latest article at Slate is Putin's Puppet: If the Russian President Could Design a Candidate to Undermine American Interests and Advance His Own, He'd Look a Lot Like Donald Trump. Well, there's no question that Putin is trying to tip the scales in Europe in terms of investing in money in Marine Le Pen, the right-wing populist in France, and of course, he's been a patron of Golden Dawn in Greece, Attica in Bulgaria, and Jobbik in Hungary. But in terms of tipping the scale in Donald Trump's favor, what evidence do we have apart from Trump's frequent valentines to Putin?
So there are a couple things we can see, some of which are ambiguous, some of which are unambiguous. Unambiguously, we can see the ways in which Russian propaganda in the form of Russia Today and in various other outlets that Putin has created to promote Russian interests, those have been going fairly full throttle in Trump's defense, and they've been vociferously anti-Clinton. So that much is unimpeachable. Then, as you mentioned, we have evidence that Russian intelligence has hacked the servers of the Clinton Foundation and the DNC. And interestingly, as soon as those hacks were uncovered, it seems like they decided to operationalize the material that they purloined and started to appear almost instantaneously on the internet. So that's another data point. And then the third, which is even more circumstantial than that, is that the Trump campaign is managed by a guy called Paul Manafort, who's worked with various Russian oligarchs over the course of the last decade. And one of his primary achievements as a political consultant was the election in Ukraine of Viktor Yanukovych, who helped bring Ukraine into the Russian sphere of influence and turned the country away from Europe. And so, and then there are other characters in the campaign's roster who have relationships with Gazprom, the Russian state natural gas company, who have been close to Putin and the Kremlin in one way or another. And that's highly circumstantial. That part of it, the case is highly circumstantial. It's suspicious, but it may signify nothing. But I think if we aggregate the evidence, it seems to suggest that Putin is at the very least experimenting with ways of trying to tip the election in Trump's direction without himself taking too heavy-handed a role, because I think he understands that he himself would be a counterproductive flashpoint in a campaign.
Well, it's no secret that Donald Trump is not popular on Wall Street because he's taken down a bunch of banks, and the Wall Street bankers have long memories. So we know that Trump lacks creditworthiness and that basically he's promoting a brand, and that essentially he sells the brand. He's a franchisor, really. And we know that he's gone after Gaddafi's money. In other words, you can't get legitimate clean money because you've already taken a bunch of banks down. So he has a history of looking around for dirty money. So the Russians are generating more dirty money than just about anybody else. We know from the Panama Papers about that. I understand that there's some research being done on tracing oligarch money from Russia that gets laundered through Israel, through the Russian mob there, and then ends up in Trump Towers. So have you heard anything about those investigations?
Yes. Yeah, so I don't know anything about that. I don't know specifically what you're referring to, but I do know that so when Trump was recovering from his 2004 bankruptcy, he was especially desperate for partners and for capital, and desperate not just to be a guy who was a reality TV star, but who continued to be a builder. And so one of the groups that he turned to was a very small, unknown outfit called Bayrock, which was based in Trump Tower and run by a Russian-American called Felix Sater, who had been connected to a mafia-run stock firm and had been indicted for a stock fraud scheme, and who'd also done time for cutting a guy's face open with a shard of margarita glass in the middle of a barroom fight. And so Sater worked with Trump to put together the financing for Trump Soho, for Trump projects, and two Trump projects in Fort Lauderdale, one in Arizona, and others across the globe, including in Moscow. And the money that Sater was getting came primarily from Russia, Kazakhstan, and a group in Iceland, which was notorious for laundering money for rich Russians. So, and Trump had to have been aware, just given the centrality of these projects to his own image, and just given the scale of these projects, and given the fact that he had his own money at stake in these projects, he had to have been aware where the dollars were coming from. And again, this is highly circumstantial, but at the moment that he came to depend so highly on this Russian investment, it wasn't just in these Bayrock projects that I'm describing. It was also the money that helped fund the Trump Towers in Toronto and other projects across the world. At the same time, he became dependent on this Russian money. his praise for Putin and kicked up to kind of almost an absurd level, describing Putin as the greatest leader in the world. When Putin wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, Trump described it as a masterpiece. It wasn't just detached admiration for Putin. It was an enthusiastic endorsement that he began delivering.
Well, of course, there's been a lot of loose talk about Trump being a fascist, etc., when clearly there's some distinction between American right-wing populism and European fascism. But a right-wing talk show host, a very popular guy in Charlie Sykes in Wisconsin, refers to Trump as the Orange Duce, referring to, of course, to Mussolini. But the real comparison would be between Trump and Berlusconi. And Berlusconi, needless to say, is one of Putin's closest friends in the West. They've shared all kinds of vices together. And Berlusconi, Trump, Erdogan, Putin, there's a similarity there. There's an authoritarian streak, a lack of respect for the law, and a love of money and power.
Yes. No, I quite agree. And I think that is the model. I think that Trump, like Berlusconi, is not a theoretical thinker. He has a set of instincts, and almost what makes Trump so unique is it just seems like he's almost ignorant of American constitutional and political traditions, if not ignorant of them, he pays little respect to them. And if he's not, I agree with you that he's not precisely fascist, but there is something fascistic about him, in the same sort of way that there is something. You know, Putin is not a fascist by any stretch, there is something fascistic about him. And with Trump, I mean, there's this confusion between himself as a figure and the country. And so, all of his prescriptions amount to, I can solve it because I know how to win. And even in his campaign, he's confused his own interest and the national interest in a way that's highly troubling. And Russia is a perfectly good example of this. So Trump has clear financial interests in having good relations with the Russian government. But he's also made that his campaign position. And is he taking this position in order to benefit personally, or does he sincerely believe in it? And does he even care about the distinction between those two things? It's hard to say.
Well, I would suggest that his remarks about the Brexit when he was opening a golf course in Scotland say it all. He thought the Brexit vote, even though it's been a catastrophe and the pound has dropped its lowest level in memory, he said it's going to be good for him. So I think that's the political economic nexus.
That's fairly unimpeachable evidence.
Yeah. So just in closing, though, let's talk about some of the people that are perhaps more respectable than Trump and seem to be also playing, you know, essentially being seduced into Putin's orbit. You've got Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, the former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, sitting a couple of seats away from Putin at the 10th anniversary gala celebrating Russia Today. And Russia Today, of course, is the Russian propaganda English language outlet that many liberals and leftists in this country think actually is credible, which is kind of heartbreaking how gullible they are.
It is.
Because it's a really venal operation. And if there was any ideological consistency on the political left in the West, they would be supporting the Russian Communist Party, who hate Putin. They're the authentic people to support, not this political gangster. So what's your sense of...
Ian, one side note about Michael Flynn is that, according to some speculation that's circulating right now, maybe credible, maybe not. It's vice presidential speculation, so it's probably inherently uncredible. But he's a name, Michael Flynn is a name who's being kicked around as a potential second for Trump. And we don't know. So Flynn went to this gala that you just described and sat sat very close to Putin. And was, of course, it's a major coup for Putin to have a former head of defense intelligence sitting there at the celebration of his propaganda apparatus's 10th anniversary. When Politico broke news of his presence there, there was the piece essentially guessed that he had gotten paid for attending. It seemed like informed speculation on their part, but maybe just speculation. There was a time at which he was a regular on Russia Today denouncing American foreign policy, which is just an incredible thing to imagine a former head of defense intelligence going on another country's propaganda station to denounce the United States. It's really kind of hard to imagine happening, but there it is.
Well, just in closing, aren't we not to expect some more dirt coming on Hillary Clinton via the Russians and Russia Today coming from Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, who, you know, WikiLeaks were going to release some material on embarrassing to Russia some many years back, and suddenly they stopped doing it, and there's a rumor that they've been funded by FSB, and there's no question that Assange hosts a show on Russia Today. So whether or not he's a useful idiot, as the KGB used to refer to gullible Westerners, or whether he's on their payroll, he's about to dump a lot of dirt on Hillary, is he not?
He claims that he is, and for any of your listeners who have any doubt about Assange has essentially said that he's pro-Trump in this election. There's the great hero of the left. But Assange has been has blustered quite a bit about the wealth of material that he has on Hillary, and seems to be suggesting that he's just biding his time, waiting for the right moment to put it out there.
Well, Frank LaFleur, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Frank LaFleur, who's a New America Fellow and a contributing editor at Slate Magazine, and he's currently writing a book about the dark side of Silicon Valley. And his latest article at Slate is Putin's Puppet: If the Russian President Could Design a Candidate to Undermine American Interests and Advance His Own, He'd Look a Lot Like Donald Trump. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the Koch brothers got a federal judge to rule that their right to spend unlimited amounts of dark money to shape elections is comparable to the rights of the NAACP to keep its membership lists secret from the KKK, who were out to kill civil rights workers in the 1950s.
How low were you willing to go before you reach all your selfish goals? After invasion, this means war. This means war. Someday.
I'd like to buy the Coke the world so they'd leave us alone. Then go back to Park Avenue and crawl beneath their stone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is John Dunbar, who's the Deputy Executive Editor of the Center for Public Integrity and creator of Consider the Source, the Center's ongoing investigation of the impact of money on state and federal politics. His latest article at the Center for Public Integrity is Koch Brothers' Plight Likened to That of Civil Rights Workers in the 1950s. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Dunbar.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And U.S. District Judge Manuel Real has ruled, at least he's ruled in terms of an injunction, and the people that made the arguments before him represent the Koch brothers and one of their front groups, Americans for Prosperity Foundation. And believe it or not, the judge appears to have bought the argument put forth by the Koch brothers' lawyers that billionaires who donate dark money to these 501c4 hidden so-called social welfare vehicles need to be protected in the way that civil rights workers, in particular African Americans, needed to be protected in the civil rights battles back in the 1950s and 1960s, likening the Koch brothers' plight to the historic Alabama decision allowing the NAACP to keep its membership list secret. How did they get this far? That's an extraordinary abuse of history, and it's offensive to all of the civil rights workers and the African Americans who risk their lives to bring about civil rights justice.
Well, it's been an argument that they've been using consistently, which is why I wrote the piece. There doesn't seem to be any sense of shame in it, in the usage. It's been used in a lot of cases. There doesn't seem to be any sense of optics, I guess, is what I would say, that somebody would look at that and say that somebody who is worth $40 billion is in some way in need of the same level of protection as somebody who was literally having their being shot at and having their homes bombed in the 1950s. You know, the way the story came about was we had written at the center, we do a lot of pieces on these dark money groups. We wrote about an organization that was funded by the Koch brothers, and we asked them who their funders were, and they said, we're not required by law to tell you, and they cited this case, and they were very explicit that we should include that argument in the piece, and even to the point where I thought, this is ridiculous, this is nonsense, I'm not going to put it in the story, to where they actually called back and made sure that we put it in the story. And ever since they were so aggressive about it, I got really curious about, you know, the legitimacy of that argument. And, you know, what it does is it sort of, it pushes it about as far as you can go in terms of when it comes to putting money into politics, is there ever a time when disclosure is not or should not be required? And, you know, and that's sort of what I wanted to explore. And it turns out there is a time when disclosure, not just in money and politics, but disclosure of members of an organization to the government should be an exemption. But there, you know, those exemptions are incredibly rare, and you know, historically, you know, you quite literally have to go back, you know, decades to find an example where there should be an exemption. And the idea of exempting a bunch of billionaires who are backing these dark money groups, I think, you know, your reaction is not unique. I think a lot of people have found that to be really quite offensive.
Well, what it says is that the law of the land is extending its protection to incredibly well-protected billionaires who are not just insulated by the 40 to, I think, up to about 80 billion the Koch brothers have in total. They live in vast protected estates. They have huge security. And the idea that people like that need to be protected in this country, as opposed to people who suffer discrimination and brutality, and the history, the case, historical case is clear. We know what happened, particularly in the 1950s when the Klan was running the South, that if you remember the NAACP and they knew about it, you'd be killed and lynched and firebombed. So I just find it unbelievable that that we are really, the law is now protecting plutocrats, not citizens.
Yeah, and in that, you know, that extends to you know, it's more than just, you know, I should say that that's a federal court judge. He's been overruled before. It'll probably go to the Ninth Circuit. There's a chance that he'll be overruled again. But this argument, this just general argument that it has extended to this, the dark money groups themselves, which I find, you know, far more sweeping and more of a concern if you're a support open government, particularly how elections are funded. You know, and the idea is that if, you know, they have a sister group. The Americans for Prosperity Foundation has, their sister group is a dark money group, and they share quarters and staff, et cetera. So the sister dark money group, which spends, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars on advertising, mostly trashing candidates. And I should say that, you know, Democratic groups also have super PACs or have nonprofits that, that do the same thing. You know, the issue at hand right now is that, you know, this is where the term dark money has come from. Basically, you've got a nonprofit that is using money that's that is expressly advocating for the defeat of a or the success of a candidate, and the money that it's being that it's using to expressly advocate for the defeat of that candidate is secret. And there is, you know, in an election, that's just not the way it's supposed to work. And the Supreme Court has said that in as many words. So, you know, flash forward, and now we've got, you know, what is your excuse? What is your explanation as a dark money group to keep your donors secret? And the idea that we need to keep our donors secret for fear that they're going to be harassed, or there's going to be repercussions, or they're in danger, or there's going to be some sort of financial or economic difficulty where they'll be fired from their jobs or whatever. It's just, it's nuts. I mean, in my view, it's crazy. And it's absolutely counter to what the Supreme Court said about disclosure. They said, you know, in the Citizens United decision, which is this now notorious decision, which came through in 2010, said, you know, as long as disclosure is good, then everything's okay, and we can let, you know, corporations and labor unions and billionaires spend as much money as they want trying to elect or defeat a candidate, just as long as it's an independent group, and just as long as the money's not going directly to the candidate. You know, it just has to be an independent expenditure. So this idea that, you know, and we're seeing this argument in the states a lot, and there's a lot more movement in the states of forcing these dark money groups to actually reveal their donors. But this argument that, you know, somehow we're being, you know, we're in danger of being harassed and people are going to come after us is a giant red herring. It's more than a red herring. You know, I think as some of the people in the story said, it's a disservice to those people in the 1950s who truly were in danger and fear for their lives, who were in danger of harassment by not only, you know, by private forces, but by the government itself. You know, in that case, in that Alabama case, the state of Alabama was quite literally trying to run the NAACP out of the state, and they actually succeeded for a while until the Supreme Court came in and made its ruling and said, no, this is not right. They shouldn't be forced to turn over the names of the members of the organization.
Now, when you mentioned, John, the Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, that's led to this, opened the floodgates of money, both open and dark, into a political system in historic proportions. Rather naively, sir, Justice Kennedy thought that disclosure would go along with it, and a disclosure has not happened. And the logic of disclosure is such that, by definition, it would limit the amount of money going in, because big corporations, most of whom I think that CEOs tend to be more Republican than Democrat, they also have to look at the bottom line and recognize that half of their customers are Republicans and half of their customers are Democrats. So they don't want to alienate half of their customers one way or the other. So there's a sort of natural kind of regulatory process underway with disclosure. It has a limiting effect. In the same way, for example, that the Fairness Doctrine prior to when Ronald Reagan lifted it had a limiting effect over the networks and in terms of their political speech. And basically, if you wanted to, if you were a Rupert Murdoch, when back in the days of the Fairness Doctrine, if you wanted to spout your political beliefs on through your newspapers and TV stations, you'd have to offer up equal time to the opposite point of view, and that limited the kind of partisan and extreme political speech. So when Reagan lifted that, of course, it led directly to Fox News, which has become a kind of Pravda of the Republican Party. So these are examples of how you can regulate without a heavy footprint, in other words. So at this point, is there any possibility that anything will stop the Koch brothers? They've already intimidated the IRS, the Republicans have in particular, doing the bidding of the Koch brothers. And as you say, now they're using the law and the protection of the law to suggest that billionaires are being harassed in the ways that civil rights workers belonging to the NAACP in the South, whose lives were at stake, were harassed. So looking forward, is there anything out there on the horizon that would indicate that anything will be done to curb the power of plutocrats in this country?
Well, that's a question for the age, isn't it? Especially when it comes to campaign finance. I think that there is and I've said this before, and we tend to go in cycles when it comes to money in politics. I feel like that it's taken a while for the citizenry to catch up with the impact and the effect of that Citizens United decision and to understand just really how profound it was. And I think that there has started to be somewhat of a backlash. We've seen it talked about in the presidential race, primarily by the Democrats, especially by Bernie Sanders, but also by Hillary Clinton, who, by the way, is benefiting greatly from the Citizens United decision. You know, their argument is that we're not going to unilaterally disarm, but whatever, that's a story for another day. I think that, you know, with the death of Justice Scalia, who interestingly was a staunch supporter of disclosure, very strong supporter of the concept of disclosure of contributions, that it opens up a position on the U.S. Supreme Court that provides, you know, if a pro campaign finance reform, anti Citizens United justice were to be nominated, that, you know, wouldn't happen right away, but perhaps a few years off, that you actually might see some movement. I think the other thing, if you're a supporter of you know, open government, transparency, especially in transparency in money and politics, is what's happening at the state level. You know, we're seeing a lot of interesting laws being passed in the states, where the states are requiring these nonprofit dark money groups to actually provide the names of their donors, and the states have absolute right and authority to do that based on that Supreme Court decision, which said, you know, disclosure is okay. So, you know, we can see some sunshine shining through there. That doesn't stop the organizations from spending, you know, as much as they want. And, you know, you mentioned corporations. You know, one of the things that we've suspected about these dark money groups is that they are conduits for corporate money, because the corporations are worried about backlash of not only you know, consumers, but also shareholders. And we don't know, because it's dark money, because we're not seeing it. So, you know, there's some incremental progress being made. We're seeing, I think we're seeing more effort put into trying to change this. I think what is discouraging, if you are looking for reforms, though, is that previous reforms on campaign finance have been bipartisan, and unfortunately, this is become a partisan issue now. You as long as you've got a Republican-dominated House, at least if you're looking for a legislative solution at the federal level, you're just not going to get anywhere. So really what you're looking for, you know, is a what you would call a jurisprudence approach, where a case would come up from the states, eventually make it to the Supreme Court, and would in some way overturn, you know, a part or all of that Supreme Court decision, that Citizens United Supreme Court decision. So at least there's the conversation about it. The likelihood of there being a lot of change, can't say, can't really handicap it. However, I would say that without being insensitive, I do think with an opening for potentially a more enlightened judge, justice on the U.S. Supreme Court, that there is, you know, potentially there's could be some change down the road. But, you know, we're talking about years.
Well, we also know that the judge that was put forth by President Obama to replace Justice Scalia has been blocked by Mitch McConnell, the Republican majority leader of the Senate, on the basis that McConnell says, well, we have to wait for the next election so that the American people could decide. Well, presumably, since their candidate, the Republicans' candidate, is Donald Trump, what McConnell is saying is we have to wait for a President Donald Trump to decide who's on the Supreme Court. At the same time, McConnell himself has not endorsed Trump. So it's a completely surreal situation that McConnell is putting forth. But in terms of Judge Manuel Riel, who ruled in favor of the Koch brothers in this injunction, likening their plight to that of the civil rights workers with the NAACP, whose lives are being threatened by the Klan in the 1950s in the South, and that they needed to keep their lists secret. You said that the Ninth Circuit may overturn it. Judge Riel, I think, was a Reagan appointee, wasn't he?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. So that at least, and he's been overturned before, right?
Yeah. In fact, in the same case, he had the court turn back a decision that he made and ordered what they call a bench trial, to where he, you know, held a full trial with the parties and then came back and then issued an opinion that was, you know, it surprised quite a few people. So there's a, you know, that, like I said, there's a good chance that that's going to be overturned. But, you know, I really wanted to focus on that particular case because it was the most full-throated, you know, version of does this case apply or not that I'd seen. And to actually see a judge sort of buy this argument, to me, was kind of remarkable.
Well, John Dunbar, I thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with John Dunbar, who's the Deputy Executive Editor of the Center for Public Integrity and creator of Consider the Source, the Center's ongoing investigation of the impact of money on state and federal politics. His latest article at the Center for Public Integrity is Koch Brothers' Plight Likened to That of Civil Rights Workers in the 1950s. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.